Our new technology is helping us get things done quicker. We're emailing and speed dialing, downloading things to read from the web, flipping through dozens of TV channels with our remote controls, and of course, multitasking every step of the way. And it's making many of us a little tense. My guest James Glick puts his finger on our culture's quickening pulse in his new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. He's the former New York Times science correspondent and author of previous books about chaos theory and physicist Richard Feynman. In his new book, Faster, Glick considers what we're gaining and losing as new technology speeds us up and offers a dizzying array of choices. For example, with the help of the internet and CD-ROM, it's easier to get access to magazines, newspapers, and books than ever before. But there are consequences.
I just saw that the entire corpus of Mad Magazine is being released on CD-ROM. You know, all the 700 or whatever it is issues from the 1950s onward, you can just call them up on your computer screen. Well, I remember when I was a kid, Mad Magazine was a sort of mysterious treasure. I would see it at friends' houses, and I never knew exactly how you got that. And when I had one, I just would sit with it for hours and hours and really study the thing. Not necessarily claiming that made me a better person, but I gave it my all. If you can just press a button and get any one of 785 issues, it is just not possible that you're going to devote a full hour to any one issue. It's just not going to happen. And you have to ask whether something isn't being lost there.
Well, since time is what everybody's trying to save, you have some very interesting stuff about time in your new book. In fact, you visited the Directorate of Time. At least that's what it used to be called. What's it called now?
Now they're calling it the Time Service Bureau, I think. It's not quite as romantic a name. But
What is the Bureau?
Either way, it's the agency of the military that's responsible for telling us what time it is. They've got the atomic clocks. They've got a bunch of atomic clocks all scattered around a hillside and all linked fiber optically and all measuring time to the one nine billionth of a second and cooperating with counterparts overseas. This is not a purely American exercise either. And what time they say it is, that's what time it is. They determine the time. They don't just watch it go by. And everybody needs to know. Television stations and radio stations have atomic clocks. They have to be exactly accurate or there are problems with their signal. And, of course, the military uses precise timing to guide munitions these days because thanks to the global positioning system, time is equivalent to location. And one nanosecond, a billionth of a second, is equivalent to 1 foot, because that's how far light travels in that time.
Why is it part of the Defense Department?
Well, there is that military application. And I guess there's a historical reason, too, which is that time a century and a half ago was most important to all the people on Earth who cared about the time. The kind of person who cared most was a sailor, and for the same reason that time equaled position. You couldn't know where you were at sea if you didn't know exactly what time it was. So the naval observatories set standard time. This was in the era before railroads, and the Directorate of Time is in the old U.S. Naval Observatory building to this day in Washington.
Now, you visited, as part of the research for your book, an airline control center. And you write that the paradox of efficiency means that as the web tightens, it grows more vulnerable to small disturbances. Explain what you mean by that.
Yes. Airlines run more efficiently now than ever before. That's an undeniable fact. They use computers to schedule the flights and the movements of pilots and flight attendants and the timing of aircraft maintenance. And there are 1,000 variables that they have to juggle, you know, union rules and fuel and winds. And it's a really complicated math problem. working out an efficient schedule that doesn't waste aircraft and doesn't waste crews staying overnight someplace when they don't need to. And if you track any particular plane from one place to the next, you discover that the computer has them going on weird routes. They don't just fly back and forth between New York and Chicago. They fly from New York to Chicago to Dallas to Phoenix to Toronto, and it's a long time before that route ever repeats, if it does. The problem is, because it's so efficient, there aren't extra planes sitting around with nothing to do or extra flight crews when something goes wrong. So if there's an equipment failure or a thunderstorm that delays a plane or a pilot oversleeps someplace, the effects of that can cascade through the system and be felt for days. They showed me, we looked in real time at the computer displays that showed them what flights were late and why. And there were flights that were late because of something that happened 2 or 3 days before. It's an interesting paradox, I think, that this tightening net of efficiency makes us, in a way, more vulnerable to disruptions. Inefficiency gave us a margin of error, and you don't have to look very far into your own life and your own schedule to see that that's true for you, too.
My guest is James Glick, and he's former science correspondent for The New York Times, author of the book Chaos, and author of the new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. One of the devices now that saves us a few seconds and saves us some impatience is touch tone dialing, which, of course, isn't so new anymore. As you point out, it kind of premiered for the public at the 1964 World's Fair in the AT&T Pavilion. What was the promise of touch-tone dialing when it was such an exciting new development in telephones?
Well, touch-tone dialing was explicitly a time-saving device. That was the idea. I guess it's a sad fact that there are people alive today who might not remember that you used to have to move your finger around in a little circle to dial the telephone, and then you had to wait for the dial to click back. And I was a kid at the World's Fair in 1962 or 3, whichever it was, and I remember very well the display they had where first you were supposed to dial your own phone number and do it first on the old dial and then do it in touch tone, and a little electronic readout would tell you how many tenths of a second you had just saved. Well, that's kind of a crazy idea, isn't it? Saving tenths of a second? But the phone company, of all institutions, was and is intensely aware of how much we want to save time.
Of course, one of the paradoxes of touch-tone dialing is that although in many ways it saves us a lot of time, it's been adding a lot of frustrating time, like when you're trying to call, you know, a corporation or an insurance company or, you know, any company, usually, and you get trapped in their automated voicemail system.
Yeah.
And, boy, it could take forever to get through that.
That is true. And there are a couple of things going on there. One is that a lot of those systems are just really badly designed, and the telephone is not a good instrument of information retrieval for a lot of things. In the long run, we're going to be getting our train schedules and making our airline reservations across the internet and not using the telephone for that. It's just not the right device. But the other thing that's happening, and this is something I try to explore in the book, is that the economy is changing because of our changing relationship with time. Companies know how important time is to the consumer, and they cater to our need for speed. I mean, there are whole segments of the economy that have popped into existence because suddenly we're in a hurry. We're fast food, overnight mail, FedEx. On the other hand, companies also have come up with some clever ways to shift time from you to them. Take it away from your budget and put it on their budget. It saves a company a lot of money to lay off the human beings who used to answer your question in detail and instead have an automated system where you punch a lot of buttons and wait on hold. And there's a time saving there, but it's not time saving for you.
Right. So you're losing time, but they're gaining it.
Right.
And it's apparently financially worth it to them, at least for now.
Yeah, and of course it's like so many things, it's most true of institutions that have some sort of monopoly. So The telephone company tends to be worse than your internet service provider, and city and federal agencies tend to be the worst of all.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Glick. He's former science correspondent for the New York Times, author of the new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Glick, we're talking about his new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. His earlier books include Chaos. You've been writing about speed during a period of your life that you've been forced to slow down. In 1997, you were flying your private plane, and it crashed, and your son was killed in the crash. And you were, I think, drawn out of the plane, put on the critical list in the hospital. You survived, but you lost a leg, lost some of the use of your remaining leg. You were in the hospital for months, then went through a long period of physical therapy and rehabilitation. I mean, obviously a lot of one's values change during a period of grief and trauma. I want to just focus on time and speed, since that's what your book is about. Did your whole sense of time and the meaning of time change, for instance, during those months in the hospital?
Well, that's sort of hard. I don't think the book changed in any real way. The book was mostly finished, and the things that I believed before the accident are the things that I still believe. But those months were certainly a strange period, and a period outside of reality almost. It's hard even to remember them. And I tried to work in the hospital after the first month or two, but certainly there was nothing like a regular daily routine. There was a daily routine, but it was like a daily routine of a prisoner. And there's no way to describe the grief that was the main feature of my existence. I mean, there's certainly no way to relate it to the book, but I guess you could say, if you wanted to explore this sort of issue, that there are times in our lives when the meaning of time changes for us and our perception of time changes, and it does make you realize that the perception of the passing of time depends on the flow of events in your life. It's not an absolute thing, time, for us. It's a very subjective thing. I do say in the book that a peculiar exception to all of these trends of acceleration and understanding of time is prison. Prison is a place in society where people do time, right? And they kill time. And the relationship of a prisoner with time is very different from the relationship of somebody who's rushing to work with a briefcase and grabbing a cup of coffee at Starbucks. The seconds and minutes and hours and days pass differently depending on your circumstance.
And when you're in the hospital, what you can't really rush. What you need is patience. And patience is just the opposite of what we've been talking about, with multitasking and hurrying and all of that.
Yes. I'm not sure patience is even the right word. I mean, I wasn't there voluntarily.
Right.
You know, I had to. I was there because I had to be there, and I was healing at a certain rate. It is true that an important theme of my book is about the unchangeable rates of speed that are part of all of our lives. And a lot of those unchangeable things, kinds of timing, are biological things. I wasn't going to heal. There was nothing that was going to make me heal faster or grieve for a shorter time. In less profound ways, we have a lot of biological rhythms in our lives. I mean, you've got to sleep for a certain amount of time, and we all cheat on our sleep. You can't hurry love, as the song goes. Actually, the title of my chapter on this subject is "Decomposition Takes Time," because I came across, actually my wife came across a really funny thing on the internet by an expert in compost who was answering a question from a reader who wanted to know how to get the compost to go faster. And he was saying, well, you can't, you know, it's a biological process. Decomposition takes time.
Well, James Gluck, very good to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Terry.
James Gluck is the author of Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything.